A grandmother in Malawi sits beside her orphaned grandchildren, stirring bug-infested millet into a thin porridge. Down the hall in the local hospital, patients who can scrape together $1 a day receive life-saving AIDS medication. Those who cannot, hundreds of them, die in silence. This isn't a scene from a distant, unchangeable past. This is happening right now. In our world of unprecedented wealth and technological marvels, we've built computers that fit in our pockets and cars that drive themselves, yet a billion people remain trapped in a poverty so extreme they cannot afford the first step toward escape. The question isn't whether we can end this, we absolutely can. The question is whether we will. Walk through four different realities, and you'll see the full spectrum of human economic experience. In Malawi, a 12-year-old girl dreams of becoming a teacher while her grandmother farms depleted soil barely yielding enough to survive. International donors recently forced treatment cutbacks, creating a grotesque lottery where geography determines who lives and who dies. Travel to Bangladesh, and you'll find hope in motion. Once written off as hopeless, this nation has doubled its income since 1971. Young women in garment factories experience something revolutionary: control over their own money and futures. In Chennai, India, young women with two-year degrees earn 8 times what agricultural laborers make, transcribing medical data for Chicago hospitals. Their granddaughters are riding an IT revolution. In Beijing, young professionals display wealth unimaginable one generation ago. Within 25 years, China emerged from cultural revolution chaos to economic powerhouse. Here's something surprising. The vast wealth gaps we see today didn't exist a few centuries ago. In 1820, Western Europe's average income was roughly 90% of Africa's average income today. Nearly everyone was poor, except a tiny elite. Then something extraordinary happened. Starting around 1750 in Britain, the Industrial Revolution unlocked energy and fossil fuels powering production at unprecedented scales. Global population increased sixfold, while average income rose ninefold by 2000. This progress shattered in 1914. World War I ended European-led globalization and triggered cataclysms spanning the entire century. After World War II, the world split 3 ways: capitalist First World, socialist Second World, and post-colonial Third World. By the early 1990s, both alternative models had collapsed. Today's landscape shows stark divisions: rich countries above $20,000 per capita, middle-income nations between $4,000 and $20,000, and the poorest below $2,000. These poorest regions missed 2 centuries of sustained growth, yet practical solutions exist for nearly all their problems. A subsistence farming family earning $100 per person annually faces impossible choices. They can't save because they're chronically hungry. They can't specialize in higher value crops without roads to markets. They can't adopt better farming methods when AIDS orphans lose parental knowledge. One bad harvest wipes out everything. This trap transcends corrupt leaders or backward cultures. The destitute lack physical capital, roads power, human capital, health education, and natural capital, healthy soil. Geography compounds everything. Landlocked countries, mountains, and tropical areas face higher costs for transportation and disease control. Governments can't fund essential infrastructure when populations are too poor to tax. Cultural norms blocking women's rights undermine half the population's economic contribution. Between 1980 and 2000, 45 developing countries experienced negative GDP growth. The differentiator? Food productivity. Asia succeeded with dense populations, road networks, fertilizer, and green revolution support. Africa struggled with sparse populations, poor infrastructure, and rain-dependent farming. The objective isn't making poor countries rich immediately, it's investing enough to help them reach the first rung where self-sustaining growth can take hold. For 20 years, the IMF prescribed austerity to impoverished countries, often triggering riots and collapsing services. What's needed is clinical economics modeled after modern medicine. Good doctors recognize the body as a complex system where one failure cascades into others. They practice differential diagnosis, identifying root causes rather than treating symptoms. They understand context matters, monitor constantly, and revise as needed. Development economics has operated differently. Rich countries told poor ones, "Poverty is your fault, adopt free markets." While addressing real issues like closed trading systems, This ignored disease, geography, and inadequate rainfall. This self-serving approach let donors slash aid while pushing ideology. Clinical economics requires comprehensive diagnosis, map extreme poverty and risk factors, examine economic policy, infrastructure, and investment incentives, analyze fiscal frameworks and spending patterns, assess how geography and ecology affect development, transport conditions, agricultural potential, disease patterns, evaluate governance efficiency, cultural barriers, and social divisions. Finally, examine international relations, security situations, sanctions, and trade barriers. This diagnostic approach demands collaboration among institutions, both domestically and internationally. Differential diagnosis is just the beginning. Designing effective programs comes next. When hyperinflation hit Bolivia in 1985, prices rose 24,000% annually. The peso collapsed from 5,000 per dollar in 1983 to 2 million by July 1985. The crisis stemmed from oil price lags. Government revenues depended on hydrocarbon taxes, but while oil prices adjusted slowly, other prices soared daily. When tin markets crashed in October 1985, selling foreign exchange reserves to absorb excess currency worked despite IMF opposition, leading to a groundbreaking 1987 debt cancellation agreement. A crucial insight emerged: Bolivia's landlocked, mountainous geography created extreme transport costs, explaining its historical dependence on high-value commodities like silver, gold, tin, and coca, a factor completely overlooked despite extensive economics training. Poland's transformation required five pillars: stabilization, liberalization, privatization, social safety nets, and institutional harmonization with Western Europe. The Big Bang began January 1, 1990, eliminating virtually all price controls and steeply devaluing currency. By 2002, Poland was 50% richer per capita than 1990, the most successful post-communist growth record. China's transformation proved even more remarkable. From 1978 onward, nearly 8% annual growth reduced extreme poverty from 64% 1981 to 17% 2001. Success came from opening to foreign investment and technology, combining modern factories with skilled workers, catapulting exports from $20 billion 1980 to $400 billion 2004. Unlike Eastern Europe, China's 80% rural population allowed agricultural reform first, dramatically improving productivity while freeing labor for industry. In Sauri, Kenya, conditions were dire: falling food output, pervasive malaria, 30% AIDS prevalence, contaminated water, and depleted soils. Fertilizer cost twice the world price, and AIDS had devastated families, leaving nearly every household caring for orphans. Yet Sauri could achieve the Millennium Development Goals with proven interventions: agricultural inputs, basic healthcare, education, electricity, transport, and safe water. The total cost? About $70 per person annually for 5,000 residents. The benefits? 90% reduction in malaria, doubled or tripled food yields, improved school attendance, reduced waterborne disease, and rising incomes. In Mumbai, families live within 10 feet of railway tracks in makeshift homes, where children and elderly are frequently injured by passing trains. Like Sauri, they need investments in safe housing, water, sanitation, roads, electricity, schools, and healthcare. The key to ending extreme poverty is enabling the poorest to climb the development ladder. The extreme poor lack six major kinds of capital: human, business, infrastructure, natural, public institutional, and knowledge. Foreign aid can break the poverty trap by jumpstarting capital accumulation. If substantial and sustained, this assistance lifts households above subsistence, enabling them to save and invest, making growth self-sustaining. The costs are modest, the returns transformative. What's missing isn't money or knowledge, it's will. 2.5 centuries of economic progress make ending extreme poverty by 2025 achievable. We can now meet basic human needs globally while fostering prosperity, advancing the Enlightenment vision of rational systems improving the human condition. Previous generations conquered seemingly impossible moral challenges. Slavery abolition, colonialism's end, and civil rights succeeded through political action and perseverance, transforming the impossible into inevitable through sudden shifts in public attitudes. Action costs less than inaction. The UN Millennium Project estimates $135-195 billion needed, just 0.4% of rich world GNP, below the promised 0.7%. The United States represents nearly half the shortfall, spending 30 times more on military than foreign assistance. Evidence links extreme poverty abroad to national security threats at home. That grandmother in Malawi isn't asking for charity, she's asking for a chance. The 12-year-old dreaming of teaching isn't asking for miracles, she's asking for what we take for granted. We have the resources, knowledge, and technology. We need moral courage to act.